The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times Communities column, Forbidden Siegel
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder why accept the Bible as the Word of God as opposed to some other alleged set of scriptures. Why not a different holy book? Why not, for example, the Quran? Well, today we are having a debate regarding the Quran and the religion of Islam. Now, usually on radio debates, the host interviews his guests, and it's kind of a looser, more informal discussion taking place, sometimes leading people to talk to each other, sometimes on purpose, sometimes by accident. Today, we are taking so many pains to avoid this scenario. We are going to make this a little more like the kind of debate that would be done in an auditorium in front of an audience. Of course, it won't be exactly that way. For one thing, we only have a little under an hour, so the opening statements, closing statements, rebuttals are going to be much briefer. But we will be going nonstop without commercial interruptions. My thanks to my gracious sponsors for cooperating with that. And I will be offering my guest, Nadir Ahmad, equal time. I do want to say something about Nadir to his credit. These days, you're always hearing about people in the name of Islam doing violence when there's a cartoon drawing or a book that's accidentally burned. Nadir, when he hears things about Islam that he doesn't like, he offers to debate people, and that is to his credit. Debating has become almost a forgotten art in America. So I want to commend Nadir from the beginning. He and I probably won't agree on much, but we do agree that debating is a good thing. So I am grateful that my friend Nadir was willing to come on today. However, back to the format of the debate and the equal time. Here to enforce this equal time and function as a moderator is today's co-host for the Bob Siegel Show, Mike Friedenberg. And I'll just turn it right over to Mike.
Well, good evening. Thanks for having me here to moderate the debate. And I just wanted to mention the format here as we get going here. But first, let me introduce Nadir Ahmad. Nadir Ahmad graduated from Bradley U in religious studies. He has a website called Examine the Truth, and that website encourages discussion and dialogue on the evidences for Islam. And he has been active in Muslim missionary work for 15 years. So I look very much forward to the debate with Nadir and Bob Siegel, of course, the host of the show and a Christian apologist. So to begin with, we're going to open up with opening statements from Nadir and Bob of 3 minutes each. Then each will have 3 minutes to rebut the opening statements. Then after that, they're going to have an opportunity to ask each other's questions.
Well, there'll be a second rebuttal.
And a second rebuttal, excuse me, and a chance to ask questions of each other. I'm going to really stress for both Bob and Nadir to please keep the questions very brief and to the point. Don't make them into long statements. And I will basically say something along the lines of, hey, please get to your question if it starts going too long. Try to do that respectfully, but please do make them real questions. So with that said, I believe that Nadir is going to go first. So, Mr. Ahmad, would you please start off with your opening statement?
All right, thanks. Thank you for inviting me on the show. I think it's great that we could have these kind of debates. And there are violent Muslims out there. But there's also, I just wanted to remind you guys, there are violent Jewish people and violent Christian people, and I'm sure you would also condemn them as well. Let me just start off by, addressing a common misconception that people have about Islam. And before we even open up the scriptures, if it's okay, I just kind of want to talk about the history of the disbelievers during the era of Muhammad, who was the prophet of Islam. You see, one of the misconceptions that a lot of people have is when they open up the Quran, they automatically assume that the Quran is addressing, you know, non-believers, and these non-believers are peaceful people who have democratic values and respect human rights. And so when they see a verse in the Quran which says, okay, and fight the non-believers, or something to that effect, they automatically assume that Islam is waging war against peaceful people. So they open up the Quran with this type of presupposition, but and the only problem with that is the presupposition is false. The fact of the matter is that the disbelievers or the non-believers during the life of Muhammad were one of the most violent, intolerant, and sadistic people ever to be written in world history. And unfortunately, I don't mean to be offensive, but one of the worst perpetrators of this were the Christians. The Christians during that era did not respect religious freedom, they did not respect human rights, and they condemned religious freedom, as a matter of fact. One example I can give you from history is that Heraclius, who was the Christian emperor of the Roman Empire, declared that the entire Jewish race must be exterminated. You know? So now here's an important point, though. When you see something like that, and you see a call for this type of extermination, I don't think there's any doubt that these people here were a clear and present danger that had to be confronted. Because if it would not be confronted, they would have unleashed a brutal campaign of genocide, torture, and barbarianism until, as they quote it, all knees bend to Christ. Now, I'm sure, Bob would condemn that, and I applaud him for that. But that is the history of the Quran, the historical context. So it's wrong to just open up the Quran and assume that Islam is addressing peaceful people. That's not the context. So I just wanted to give that historical background of the Quran to address that misconception. So I'll go ahead and turn it over to Bob.
Okay, Bob, there you go.
Okay, well, since this is my opening statement, I'll respond to some of the things that Nadir said in my rebuttal. But before I begin my opening statement, I want to welcome any listeners right now who may be Muslim. In my many years on college campuses, I have met a good number of sincere Muslims. And I do believe that the ones that I dialogued with specifically were being very honest when they claimed to be peaceful. However, and this is a very significant however, whereas each and every individual Muslim must be judged on a personal basis, evaluating the Muslim religion itself is quite another matter. The Quran really does call upon Muslims to conquer the infidel. That doesn't mean to kill all of them, but to make them submissive to a Muslim country. It may mean killing them if they refuse to convert. And I'll just read a few verses from Surah chapter 9, 123. Believers make war on the infidels who dwell around you. An infidel was somebody who wasn't practicing the Muslim faith. 48:29 from the Quran. Muhammad is God's apostle. Those who follow him are ruthless to unbelievers, but merciful to one another. Surah 9:73, Prophet, make war on the unbelievers and the hypocrites and deal rigorously with them. Hell shall be their home. They uttered the word of unbelief and renounced Islam after embracing it. So they're not saying anything there about a genocide. They're talking there about the fact that they weren't cooperating with Islam. And it says not to befriend Jews and Christians. 5:51, believers take neither the Jews nor the Christians for your friends. They are friends with one another. Whoever of you seeks their friendship will become one of their number. God does not guide the wrongdoers. Now, of course, we've heard this before. Some will immediately jump in here and say, well, Bob, only the terrorists would take those words seriously and out of context. Not so. It is true that the terrorists, sadly, are interpreting the Quran correctly. But many Muslims who do not identify themselves as terrorists still abide by their own book, which makes sense. After all, to them, the Quran is sacred scripture. Now, am I saying there's no such thing as a moderate Muslim? Certainly, there are many Muslims who call themselves moderate, but follow this reasoning, and let me say this very carefully. A truly dedicated Muslim, a truly committed Muslim, knows he cannot serve God in moderation. So instead, I call truly peaceful Muslims the nominal Muslims. I don't mean an insult by the word nominal. What do I mean by nominal? Well, just as there are people who live in America or Europe who know absolutely nothing about the Bible other than a few choice ideas taken out of context, people who nevertheless call themselves Christians because they were raised with some kind of church background, there are likewise many people born into Muslim countries or raised by Muslim families. If you ask them if they believed in the Quran, they would say yes. If you ask them if they believed in the jihad, they would deny it, and they would be telling the truth. There are millions of such people, and yes, we can call them peaceful Muslims. There are also Muslims influenced by America and Western culture who try to reinterpret what the Quran says regarding violence. More on this when it's my turn again.
Thank you. So, Mr. Ahmed, your rebuttal, please.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think I heard a response to my argument. You know, I started out with a history of the Quran, you know, and I said, you know, and I made it very clear that the disbelievers during the life of Muhammad were one of the most violent, intolerant, and sadistic people ever to be recorded in world history. I don't think I heard a response from Bob, and I would like to get a little bit more feedback on it, because here's why it's important. There is the argument I'm putting forward that they were a clear and present danger. And the evidence, well, when you call for the mass extermination of the Jewish race, and they did this, unfortunately, in the name of Christianity, you know, it was either they convert to Christianity or die. You don't have to wait for them to attack you. You should see them for what they are and the threat which that posed. All of the verses which Bob Siegel actually quoted, almost all of them, came to address this challenge and fought so that people can have the right to believe in the religion of their choice, a fundamental right which the Christians of the 6th century condemned. Okay? Oh, by the way, and if anyone wants any of this historical references, please shoot me an email. My website is examinethetruth.com, and I'll give you a reference for every point, every verse which I quote here. Okay? So, yeah, the verses which he quoted, and let me just kind of... So, Bob, I'd like to hear more from you on this issue about the clear and present danger that the disbelievers presented at that time. Is that true or is it not? So make war against the unbelievers. These are just marching verses, okay? Be ruthless against the unbelievers, all right? These are just marching verses. When you look at that, you have to look at why. Why should you go to war? Okay, so you cannot take the scripture out of context. So why you should go to war is found inside chapter 4, verse 75. It says, "And what is wrong with you that you fight not in the cause of Allah? For those who are weak, ill-treated, and oppressed among men, women, and children, whose cry is, 'Our Lord, rescue us from this town whose people are oppressors, and raise for us from you one who will protect us, and raise from us one who will help us.'" So as you can see over here, the reason why the call for war and why to wage war against the unbelievers was to end oppression and to answer that call of the crying people, "Oh Lord, send us someone who will save us and rescue." If you look at from the Quran, the canonical scriptures, you will not find any other reason to go to war other than this. And that's a challenge. Oh, and the thing about don't be friends with Jews and Christians, I'm sorry, my time is up, but Bob, I think you threw out a lot of arguments at me. Unfortunately, I didn't have time to address each and one, so if you could just kind of reduce the amount of points, which will give me time to address that, that'd be great. Thanks.
Bob, your rebuttal?
Okay, well, of course, in a debate, a debater makes the points he decides to make and the amount of points he decides to make. I did respond to some of what Nadir said, because I mentioned, as I read in one of the verses, that Muhammad was given a reason of disbelief for the jihad, not the reason of genocide. However, I do want to respectfully agree with part. When Nadir looks at church history, when we look at the Crusades and the Inquisition and even some things that happened under Protestantism, in those days, for the most part, Christianity did not have a whole lot to brag about. There were atrocious things. I don't know if you're aware of this, Nadir. I myself am Jewish. I'm a Jew who converted to Christianity. So believe me, nobody is more aware of things done to Jewish people in the name of Christianity than me. Jews and well, Christians and Muslims both fought in the Crusades. Jews were victims in the Crusades. Christians and Muslims were victims in the Crusades. There's a very important difference, though. In Matthew 26, 52, when Simon Peter, his disciple, had an opportunity to defend Jesus against an unlawful arrest, and this was just defense, Jesus said, "Put your sword back in its place, for all who draw the sword will die by the sword." It's always very common when we're talking about the violence of Islam for people to turn it and say, well, yeah, but Christians did the same thing 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago, and they usually have to go back that far. And yeah, that's true, but there's a very important difference. When Christians did those things, they were doing it in disobedience to the words of Jesus. When Muslims did those things, they were doing it in obedience to Muhammad. That's a very important difference. Now, again, I want to reiterate that, that doesn't mean there aren't Muslims in America influenced by Western culture who try to reinterpret what the Quran says regarding violence. And I guess politically and as far as safety goes, I'm glad they're trying to reinterpret it. But let's be honest, it's a difficult task. And it sounds sometimes like they're trying to fit a square peg in a round hole. Yet any Muslim who takes the Quran seriously and literally, who truly understands the entire message, not only accepts the jihad commands, he or she is also taught that it's okay to lie during a time of war. But why not let Muhammad speak for himself from the Hadith? Lying is wrong except in three things: the lie of a man to his wife to make her content with him, a lie to an enemy, for war is deception, or a lie to settle trouble between people. Now, see the problem? Even the so-called moderate Muslims are allowed to lie and deny that they believe in the jihad. I don't suggest that Nadir personally is doing this. I think he fits more in the category of trying to fit the square peg in a round hole. I think he really, truly wants to believe that his religion is peaceful. But it does explain how so-called moderate organizations like CARE, Council on Islamic American Relations, was caught having ties to terrorist organizations. And we'll go ahead and let Hamar go next.
Okay. Okay. Ahmad, your response, rebuttal?
Yeah. Well, you know, the whole thing about, you know, trying to portray me as lying, you know, I think that that is a misrepresentation of our scriptures. Now, I have met very few people in this world who is going to disagree with a statement that in war, you have to lie, you have to deceive your enemy. There is not one person I have met who disagrees with that statement. But does this mean that now you can brand all Muslims as liar? Absolutely not. Let's see chapter 22, verse 30 of the Quran. It says, "Shun abomination and shun lying speech." No, Muslims cannot be liars. Chapter 6, 152, it says, "And whenever you give your Lord, say the truth, even if a near relative is concerned, and fulfill the covenant with God." So you should always speak the truth. But anyway, this is kind of off topic. I want to kind of get back to the topic. So no, Muslims cannot be liars. In fact, liars, this is a sign of nifaq, which is a sign of hypocrisy in a person. So that's the absolute worst thing you can do. But yes, in wartime, you have to lie. I mean, you cannot go to your enemy and just tell him all your positions. This is just crazy. And of course, who are the greatest liars? Then the Allied forces during World War II, and how we deceived and lied to the Germans by sending them false telegrams and stuff like that. So lying, you have to be pretty good at it to win a war. So that's actually a statement of truth. But Bob, you're missing the point here, and this is not some kind of reinterpretation, because hypothetically, if you got even the most rottenest scumbag terrorist listening to the debate, he's not going to disagree with what I'm saying, okay? There is no reinterpretation of verses going on there. What I want you to see, Bob, I want you to see the clear and present danger out there. There was a need, unfortunately, for war-like passages. It was either you engage in war or be killed. When you look at the extermination of the Jewish race, and this is the third time I'm going to raise this, wouldn't you agree with me, Bob, that these people were a clear and present danger that must be confronted? They had to be confronted. The jihad passages in the Quran confronted that threat. Okay? So this is the last time I'll bring up that point. I'm looking forward to hearing from you on that. And also, you also quoted a verse that says, "And don't take Jews and Christians as your friends." You know, there's a lot of propaganda out there, and this is one of the most common propaganda pieces. But the question is, does this mean you take them as your enemy? Of course not. They're reading into the passage over there, okay? So when it says don't take them as your friend, there is, of course, in friendship many different levels, from very high, you know, to very close friends, to very, you know, to very farther friends, you know. But let's see how Muhammad taught us to behave with the Jews and Christians. He said when he sent Mu'adh to the Jews and the Christians, he said, treat the people with ease. Don't be hard on them. Give them glad tidings and don't fill them with aversion. And love each other. Did you see that? And love each other and do not differ. So we have to read all of the passages.
We're at 3 minutes, okay. Mr. Ahmed.
Okay, well, that always sounds nice to say Muslims are not allowed to lie. The problem is he disagreed with Muhammad himself. But he did admit that during a time of war, Muslims could lie, which agrees with what Muhammad says. The question is, when are Muslims not at war? Muslims have certainly declared war on America. So what about the Jews? Yeah, I read one verse about the Jews. You want another one? Surah 582, the most implacable of men are the Jews and the pagans. That sounds like a pretty downright... downright insulting thing to me. The defense of Islam's peacefulness, and I don't just mean this from Nadir, when I listen to all the different spokespeople that are trying to defend Islam today, the defense of its peacefulness usually could be summed up in a single sentence. Honestly, Islam really is a peaceful religion. We can see where it may not always look that way. No, it does not look that way when churches are burned down in Egypt, or Bibles are forbidden in Saudi Arabia, or children in Palestinian schools are taught that Jews are evil and should be exterminated. But don't assume that alternate religions to Islam are the only targets. Homosexuals are executed in countries like Saudi Arabia, Iran, Mauritania, Saddam, Somalia, and Yemen. And when those fun-loving Taliban ran Afghanistan, they went after homosexuals with special cruelty. Of course, this did not catch as much news attention as their inhumane treatment of women. One of the more creative punishments sliced off the top of a woman's thumb for having the audacity to wear nail polish. When people call this the religion of peace, it's difficult to say it with a straight face. But with such persecution of women and homosexuals, one would think these Muslim countries would be more frequently denounced by liberals. Doesn't happen. In an ironic twist of fate, Islam managed to become a politically correct religion. It took 9/11 to make this happen. After the slitting of the throats of stewardesses, ramming planes into buildings, and then in the months that followed, beheading a man like Nick Berg while chanting to Allah and then posting the whole thing on the internet where all could share in the joy. Somehow, Islam became known as an extremely peaceful faith, and woe to any who say otherwise. Of course, it's still open season on Christianity. An American artist portrays Christ in a bottle of urine without worrying about a group of monks or nuns putting out a hit contract. Meanwhile, film director Theo Van Gogh is murdered by a Muslim for daring to make a film about Islamic violence. Well, that ought to teach us to stop calling Islam a violent religion. All right, is there a peaceful wing to Islam? There is. But the peaceful wing of Islam needs to make a better case. They can start by admitting that their cousins in the violent wing are indeed religious, not merely people who hijack religion for political gain. Why else would they be going ballistic when a Quran is destroyed, the same Quran which instructs them to make war against infidels? When a 34-year-old Christian pastor awaits execution in Iran for the crime of converting to Christianity from Islam, and other Muslims demonstrate their holiness in Afghanistan, killing Americans for an accidental burning of Quran copies, never mind that America liberated Afghanistan from the oppressive Taliban rule. The Taliban, incidentally, did not exactly respond with tears when Obama apologized for it. Instead, their spokesman said, kill them, beat them, take them as prisoners, and teach them such a lesson that they never summon the courage to abuse the Holy Quran again.
Okay. Thanks, Bob. That was your second rebuttal there. So now we're going to go ahead and open it up for questions. And we'll have Mr. Ahmed ask the first question of Bob. And Bob, you will be able to respond back, I guess, 3 minutes as well. And then after that, Mr. Ahmed will have a 2 minutes to respond back to you. If with that question there.
Oh, I'm sorry. How long do I get right now? Do I just...
You can ask a question. Just make it a question, and then Bob will ask a question of you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Bob, you know, you raised a lot of points here, and unfortunately I didn't get a chance to address all of it. But, you know, I quoted to you a verse, chapter 4, verse 75, because this is telling why there is war. What is the reason for the marching verses to go out and fight the disbelievers? And it says over here, and I didn't hear from you on this, it says, "And what is wrong with you that you fight not in the cause of Allah for those who are weak, ill-treated and oppressed among men, women, and children, whose cry is, 'Our Lord, rescue us from this town whose people are oppressors, and raise for us from you one who will protect, and raise for you one who will help.'" So
that's a question. We need the question here. So what is the question?
Yeah, I guess, well, my question is, you said that that Islam teaches to burn down churches. My question is, in light of this passage, how many churches were burned down during the life of Muhammad?
Bob, that's a question to you.
Okay. During the during the time of Muhammad, there were churches burnt down. But let me answer this more fully, because it's true that there are some verses in the Quran that teach Muslims to only fight defensively, and there are other verses in the Quran that teach Muslims to be peaceful, and there are other verses in the Quran that tell people to wage an aggressive jihad. That's because Muhammad conveniently got new revelations when the situation changed. There are three stages to jihad that we can find, and they're commonly coined stealth jihad, defensive jihad, and offensive jihad. This is very important. Stealth jihad, America would be one such place. When Muslims are completely outnumbered, when they're in the minority in their community, it says in Surah 109, 1 through 6, "Unbelievers, I do not worship what you worship, neither do you worship what I worship. I shall never worship what you worship, nor will you ever worship what I worship. You have your religion, I have mine." That sounds fine. That sounds fine. But then Muhammad explains why they're doing it. In Surah 3, "Let believers not make friends with infidels in preference to the faithful, except in defense." Now, the pagans of Mecca had no problem with Muhammad until he started attacking them. Then there's defensive jihad. That is fighting the unbelievers who pose a threat, physical or intellectual. This is when Muslims are not quite they're not quite in control of the country, but they're not quite as much the minority. When they begin to grow a little bit, then they're not quite as peaceful. At this point, they could start having riots, and they could start waging what they call defensive warfare. Parts of Africa, Europe, Nigeria, Ethiopia would be examples of that. Here in Surah 22, it says, "Permission to take up arms is hereby given to those who are attacked because they have been wronged. God has power to grant them victory, those who have been unjustly driven for their homes." During this time in Muhammad's life, and I do believe in reading things in context, what these words meant to Muhammad is what they mean. There were attacks on Meccan caravans, attacking even during the sacred month. Surah 2 said, "They ask you about the sacred month, say to fight in this sacred month is a grave offense, but to debar others from the path of God, to deny him and to expel his worshipers from the holy mosque is far more grave in his sight. Idolatry is more grievous than bloodshed." Broad definition of what constitutes an attack, criticizing is also considered an attack here. And then there's offensive jihad, like we see in Saudi Arabia today, where the majority has the political power. That was once in Mecca in Arabia under Muslim control. In Surah 9, 123, here it says, "Believers, make war on the infidels around you. Deal firmly with them. Know that God is with the righteous." The war is being made because they're infidels, not because they're being attacked. Now they are proactively waging the war. Surah 9:29, "Fight against those to whom the scriptures were given." That's Jews and Christians. As "believe neither in God nor the last day, who do not forbid what God and his apostle have forbidden, and do not embrace the true faith until they pay tribute out of hand and are utterly subdued." This is very important, Nadir, because here they're making it very clear that they're fighting people because they don't embrace the true faith. Nothing defensive.
Bob, 10 seconds.
Okay, so again, there's stealth jihad, and then there's the jihad where people are being more aggressive. There's defensive jihad, and there's offensive jihad. So we can pick and choose different verses in the Quran. It depends on which of these three kinds of jihad, which stages we are at.
Mr. Ahmed, you have a one-minute response to that. You can go up to 1 minute to respond to Bob's answer.
Yeah, and, you know, Bob, you know, you're really nailing me with a lot of arguments here. And I think what you're doing, you're venting. You're venting a lot of anger and a lot of hostility you have. And that's fine. I mean, I don't mind addressing your points, but I can't address all these points, from killing gays, from burning down churches, from the Taliban, from Nick Berg to the three stages. I can't address all these things. You just got to, we have to, I think you just really need to slow down, and let's address them one by one, please. I don't think this is fair for me. Bob, I'm just going to enlighten you. There were no churches burned down during the life of Muhammad, okay? You mentioned defensive jihad, that somehow the verse which I quoted for you was defensive. Did you did you pay attention to the wording? This is an offensive verse. This is a verse which is telling you to go out and fight for this cause. So the verse which I gave you is an offensive verse, not a defensive.
Okay. And now, Bob, you have an opportunity to ask Mr. Ahmed a question.
Defensive jihad is a title we're giving for the stage of where they're at. When they are in still the minority, but they have a little more power than they had when they were under the stealth jihad.
You need a question here.
Yeah. It's your turn
to ask. Asked the first question. Now you get to ask a question.
Okay. So maybe I'll find a way to fit that back in later. Okay, Nadir, I have a question for you. Does Israel have a right to exist? You told me to slow down, so let's just slow down. All you got here is one question, and it's not a trick question. Does the nation of Israel today have a right to exist?
Okay, how long do I get?
You have 3 minutes.
You got 3 minutes.
Okay. It's a little bit off the topic. I thought we were going to be talking about Islam and jihad in Islam. They do. They do have a right to exist because now we have millions of Jews living on stolen Arab land. And I'm glad that you raised this point because this showed that there are terrorists on both sides. And the terrorists, unfortunately, you know, which are here in America, are far worse than the Bin Ladens and the Hezbollahs and all those losers. Okay, so this is really what the problem is. We have fanatics who interpret the Bible to go invade the Middle East, take their land away from them, and give their home to Jews. And they justify this with Bible verses. Now that's the same kind of fanaticism which Osama bin Laden and all these losers do, the Taliban, hooligans, and all these people. So this is what I want you guys to understand. There are extremists on both sides. And these terrorist Americans, and we have to call them what they are, you could literally take them pictures of Palestinians thrown out of their homes, living in refugee camps. I'm like, explain this to me, will you? And they will literally crack open the Bible and justify that with Bible passages. They misuse and use the Bible to wage war against Muslims. Do you see that religious extremism? So there are terrorists on both sides. Alhamdulillah, Allahu Akbar, I'm not one of these fanatics. I don't use my religion to wage war against people, especially innocent people. But unfortunately, Bob, you are one of those people, okay? So I have no problem with condemning these losers, you know, like the Taliban and Hamas and Hezbollah and all these people. And they're not going to heaven, they're going to hell. But they are not as bad as those terrorists who justify invading the Middle East and snatching land away from the Palestinians and giving it to the Jews, and they use the Bible for this. This is a doctrine of hate. This is a doctrine of extremism masquerading as biblical prophecies. Okay? And if you look at the history of Christians, they have been doing this for the last 1,400 years. This is not new. They have been falsely interpreting their Bible to wage war on Muslims and steal their lands. It's nothing new. So, does Israel have a right to exist? Yes, of course. We cannot turn around and do the same thing which they did to the Palestinians. But anybody who just
10 seconds.
Yeah. Well, I think I had 30 seconds. We had 3 minutes, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I guess my 10 second is these people are terrorists worse than Osama bin Laden.
Okay.
I hope
Thanks.
Everybody heard that the people of Israel are terrorists worse than Osama bin Laden.
Okay. So you have a 1 minute response
okay.
to his.
And I'm going to have answer. To come back to some of this. Absolutely nothing that he said is true. It is not Jews invading Arab land. It was quite the opposite. Jews lived in that land for over 3,000 years. The Arabs first came into the land as conquerors after the birth of Islam. At the turn of the 20th century, the League of Nations invited the Jews to resettle their ancient home, but some Jews were already there. Ironically, it was after Jewish businesses created a surplus of jobs that there were some Arabs there, but more Arabs flooded into the territory en masse, creating a situation where the Arabs greatly outnumbered the Jews. In paradoxical fashion, the British, after inviting the Jews to return, sold over 75% of Palestine to the Arabs. We have had a separate Palestinian state since the turn of the 20th century. It's called Jordan. That's an extremely important and seldom taught fact. And please catch this. 75% of what had been offered to the Jews sold behind their backs to the Arabs instead. Not only were the Arabs offered a separate Palestinian state, they've been living in one. The Jews accepted this betrayal only because they had no choice.
Bob,
after all,
up.
A sliver of the promise was better than no land at all. I will return to this subject.
So now, Mr. Ahmed, you have a question for Bob.
Yeah, a question for Bob. Okay. Yeah, you know, I quoted you a hadith, and I think it's, you're not aware of it, okay? It said over here when Muhammad sent Mu'adh ibn Jabal to the Christians, he says, treat the people with ease. Don't be hard on them. Give them glad tidings, and don't fill them with aversion. And love one another, and do not differ. These are the words of Muhammad. So what does this mean to you? And this is, by the way, in the stage of the offensive jihad. Go ahead.
Well, it wasn't in the stage of the offensive jihad, and that's my answer to you. It was those were the defensive jihads, the stealth jihads, when he told them to do that kind of thing. Once they were in the offensive jihad, they were just blanket commands. Muhammad is God's apostle. Those who follow him are ruthless to unbelievers, but merciful to one another. I read that before. Prophets make war on the unbelievers and hypocrites. They're making war on them because they're unbeliever. Why? Here's why. Does it say because of exterminations? Does it say because they've been persecuting us? No, it says because they uttered the word of unbelief and renounced Islam after embracing it. Now, I do want to get back again, since I have some more time in my 3 minutes and I've answered him, to what was going on again with this whole idea with Israel, because this is very, very important. I call this the Muslim Freudian slip. You won't find a Muslim on radio or TV who says they embrace terrorism. They all renounce it categorically. But if you ask the very simple question, the Israeli-Palestinian situation, you start hearing all this stuff about how the Jews stole Arab land. And the reason that's important is because people are trying to make that the reason for the violence today, that and their views about America. But again, 75% of what the League of Nations offered Israel was sold behind their backs, and now a little sliver was being partitioned. Again, the Jews said, well, a sliver is better than nothing at all. But the Arabs didn't want the Jews to have even a sliver, and a fresh controversy broke out over what to do with the remaining 25%. To appease the Arabs, the new United Nations voted to divvy up the remaining 25% between the Jews and the Arabs. For the second time, the Arabs are offered a Palestinian state. This was back in 1947. The Jews accepted this partition. The Arabs did not. Let me say that again. The Jews accepted it. The Arabs did not. After the partition vote from the United Nations, Israel declared its independence on May 14, 1948. One day later, five Arab countries, Muslim countries, invaded Israel from Egypt, Transjordan, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq. This war had nothing to do with allowing a two-state solution because the Arabs rejected a two-state solution. Indeed, the Arabs waged war because they were rejecting a two-state solution. Their stated goal was the complete extermination of Israel. The king of Saudi Arabia said there are 50 million Arabs. What does it matter if we lose 10 million people to kill all of the Jews? The price is worth it. The Secretary General of the Arab League said this will be a war of extermination and momentous massacre, which will be spoken of like the Mongolian massacres. The Grand Mufti of Jerusalem said, I declare a holy war, my Muslim brothers. Murder the Jews. Murder them also. Who's doing the violence? Who's doing the extermination? This is in the 20th century. I already said to Nadir right at the top that if you go back to the Crusades and the Inquisitions, the church has nothing to brag about. But again, the church was doing that in disobedience to the words of Jesus. Muslims are doing that in obedience to the words of Muhammad. Yes, he told them to be peaceful at times, but it depends on which of the three stages of jihad they were.
Time is up. Mr. Ahmed, you've got a minute response to Bob's answer to your question.
Yeah, you know, this is kind of turning into a political discussion. I just want to correct you. The verse which I quoted for you, or the hadith, was actually during jihad, okay? And there are several passages like this. And by the way, I also want to correct you. There is no verse in the entire Quran or in the entire all canonical scripture that says, make war against people because they are unbelievers. You are making up a verse of the Quran, Bob. Okay, and if so, I would challenge you, what verse says that? This is just nonsense. I already given you the reason for war. But, you know, you're missing the point about Israel, Bob, and you seem to be running away from this. I've pointed out to you that there are terrorists in America who justify the oppression of the Palestinian people with Bible verses. They say not an inch of land to be given back to the Palestinians based on these verses of the Bible. Those terrorists are worse than Osama bin Laden.
Okay, that time is up there. And now I guess we get to have a question from Bob, right?
Okay.
To Ahmed, Mr. Ahmed.
Mr. Ahmed, are you aware that these verses that you say I'm not reading, where Muhammad told people to go out and kill because they were unbelievers, are you aware that I've not only have read them, but have read them several times? That's my question. Are you catching that?
Yeah, I got that. I think you might be mistaken here. There's no verse in the Quran which teaches to wage war against unbelievers because they are unbelievers. The reason for war, it was given in chapter 4, verse 75. And there is no other reason. It says, and what is wrong with you that you fight not in the way of Allah for those who are weak, ill-oppressed, and whose cry out, O Lord, help us and rescue us from this town whose people are oppressors. There is no other reason given. And if so, I want you to give me the verse. I would like for you to read it out of the Quran and tell me what it says, because I don't think there is anything like there. But I think what we've learned from this discussion is there are terrorists on both sides. There are people who...
We need to make this a question here.
Oh, right? I'm sorry. Am I supposed to ask Bob a question?
Bob...
Okay.
My response.
Well, again, Nadir, if you didn't catch them before, I am reading these. I've read the entire Quran cover to cover. Now, I'm not going to claim I know Islam as well as you. You don't know Christianity as well as me. But I've read them. Surah 9, 123, believers make war on the infidels who dwell around you. The believers are the Muslims. The infidels are the non-believers. They're making war on them because they're non-believers. 48:29, Muhammad is God's apostle. Those who follow him are ruthless to... what, attackers? Ruthless to those who do genocide? No, ruthless to unbelievers, but merciful to one another. Surah 973, prophet make war on the unbelievers and the hypocrites and deal rigorously with them. Why? Because they uttered the word of unbelief and renounced Islam after embracing it. So I have read these. Nadir, you're a nice guy, and I like you. And I said, I appreciate the fact that you're here. But as I said before, you are trying to fit a square peg in a round hole. You said you didn't like me listing all the different things that Muslims do all over the world. But yeah, it is overwhelming. The verses in the Quran are overwhelming. The verses in the Hadith are overwhelming. You've got a difficult job, my friend. You're trying to make the Quran and your religion something it isn't. What I'd like to offer you instead is a relationship with the God of the Bible, the real God who loves you and wants to speak to you as clearly as Muhammad claimed he spoke to him. I believe, my friend, that in your own way, you are seeking this God. And I want to invite you to this God, because this task that you have of trying to say that Islam is not a violent religion, or that the violence always has something to do with Israel, something to do with the United States, this moral equivalency that there's terrorism on both sides. The terrorism that goes on in the Middle East is from Palestinians to Israel. Yasser Arafat basically invented terrorism as we know it. He was a cutthroat. Mm-hmm. He was a murderer. He was a rapist.
Okay.
Ask the people of Lebanon when they went into there.
Can I make a suggestion here? Just because the way the minutes are going is we're getting to the point where maybe a question's answered and then people feel like they have to fill in time there. So I'm going to actually just suggest that we can get the time back and forth down to a little bit smaller amounts of time, so we get back and forth, a little more back and forth dialogue for the last few minutes.
That would be okay with
you. Because I just noticed that there was sort of an awkwardness with the amounts of times you were talking about here. So, Ahmed, would you like to respond back to Bob here?
Sure. And how long do I get?
Let's say a couple minutes here, because we just got a few minutes left, so a couple minutes.
Yeah, Bob, I'm looking at 9:123 in front of me, chapter 9, verse 123. It says, oh, you have believed, fight those adjacent to you of the disbelievers and let them find harshness in you, okay? And know that Allah is with the righteousness. Okay. But see, Bob, I think you're reading into the verse what's not there. It doesn't say, and fight them because they are non-believers. That is not there. You keep saying that there's a verse which says, fight them because they utter a word of unbelief. There's nothing like that in the Quran, Bob. Okay, now I have a Quran in front of me, and I would like for you to show me where it teaches.
Well, Nadir, it says that they're fighting.
Okay, but Bob, is that...
And the last point is, okay. I've already explained, these are just marching verses. The reason to go out and fight, you've got to read inside chapter 4, verse 25. That's the reason. These are just marching verses you're telling us, so it doesn't really tell us about that. And ruthless to the non-believers, yes. That is in the context of war. So, Mike, go ahead. It's your turn.
Okay, Bob.
It was in the context of war. It was ruthless, and they certainly were marching orders, but the reason was given. Believers, that's the Muslims, make war on the infidels. Now, an infidel is somebody who is not a Muslim. Now, I can understand why Nadir might want it spelled out even more specifically than that, but it was spelled out even more specifically, same chapter, Surah 9, but in verse 73. And I don't mind reading it again, because I think these verses speak for themselves. Isn't it interesting? I'm just quoting what the Quran says. Nadir's trying to explain to me what it really means. It says, Prophet, make war on the unbelievers. Make war. They're waging the war, and the hypocrites, and deal rigorously with them. Hell shall be their home. And now, Nadir, my friend, they offer the reason. Here's the reason. They uttered the word of unbelief and renounced Islam after embracing it. Now, you're a nice guy, but I have to ask you, what part of the sentence uttered the word of unbelief and renouncing Islam are you having difficulty understanding?
What verse are you quoting?
I'm quoting Surah 973.
Oh, 973. Yeah, I was just on there.
Okay, well, now you're going to explain to us how that really doesn't say what it says, right?
Yeah, I got 973 there, and do I get a minute response?
Yeah, sure. Get a minute.
Yeah, it doesn't say any of that. It says, O Prophet, fight the disbelievers and the hypocrites, and be harsh upon them. And their refuge is hell. A wretched is a destination. There's none of this thing because they utter a word of disbelief. I think you're reading some commentary, right?
No, I'm reading from the N.J. Daywood. He was an Iraqi scholar, the first translation in English. However, look, I've compared it to other translations. Shakir Khan Ali, I've compared it to other translations. Do they more or less say the same thing?
Yeah, I got all translations on my computer. Okay. Which one are you reading
from? I was reading from the N.J. Daywood, but you know what? Okay. That's the wonder of the internet. Anybody listening right now can go to the Quran online, and they can see which of us is telling the truth. I was reading from the N.J. Daywood translation.
Here's what you could do, Bob. You know,
and I was reading it in an actual book. It wasn't even just pulling it off the internet.
Right. Yeah, okay, now here's the thing. I mean, and I hate to, throw out the old Arabic canard, but if you read the verse in Arabic, and I actually have it right in front of me, none of this stuff about, because they uttered a word of unbelief or because they're disbelievers, none of that is in the text. Okay, so you can go straight to the Arabic and read that inside there. And let me pull up the N.J. Daoud version, because I think you might be reading the stuff in brackets, but that's not in the text, okay? So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to you while I look up the other translations you quoted. Because Yusuf Ali, I also read that. It's not there as well.
I don't believe you actually read Arabic yourself, do you, Nadir?
No, yeah, I read. In fact, we speak Arabic in our home.
You speak Arabic in your home? Because I was told by David Wood, who you debated, that you don't speak Arabic.
No.
Was he telling? Okay, so David Wood was...
For years. My wife's an Arab.
David Wood was telling me something that wasn't true?
I don't know what David Wood told you.
Okay, well, I'll ask him. However, I do want
to
get back...
Would you like to read it in front of you?
You are not of the opinion that if one can't read Arabic, they can't read a translation of the Quran, are you? Because you'd be leaving out Muslims all over the world.
I'm trying to look up your translation.
Most Muslims around the world do not read Arabic. They do read the translations into the language. And this was a translation from an Arab scholar, so unless you want to say that this Arab scholar, Daywood, did not know Arabic as good as you, then that's not much of an argument, is it?
I rely on the English as well there.
Then we found something to agree on. So don't fault me for quoting the English. I have heard you refer to the Bible. I don't think you know Hebrew and Greek. So anyway.
So we're down to just a few minutes left here. So why don't we each of you take for closing statements, up to 3 minutes each.
Okay, I'll go ahead and let Nadir go first.
And then Nadir will go first, sure. I do. Who went first the first time?
Can Bob go first?
Oh. Yeah, Bob, actually, let's have you go first. And then Nadir, because didn't Nadir go first in the first?
Yeah, I did.
I believe he did.
Okay, so then we'll let Nadir close out the last 3 minutes.
Okay, well, again, I think this was very important. What's been happening here. And I know that Nadir said that when I asked him a question about Israel, that I was changing the subject. I'm not. I want to go back and I want to remind or educate the audience on what's going on here. Usually when Muslims are confronted about the violence in the Quran, they try to change the subject by saying, well, there's terrorism going on today, but there's terrorism from the United States. There's terrorism from Israel. In his debate with David Wood, he called the Israelis terrorists for invading Arab land. Now, I already showed you how that did not happen. The Jews lived in that land for 3,000 years. In fact, there's never been a country called Palestine. The word Palestine was coined when Emperor Hadrian, who had conquered, previous Roman emperors had conquered Israel, but he went and just finished the job because there had been a revolt. He got so fed up with the Jews that he changed the name of the land to match their old enemies, the Philistines, who were extinct by now. But the Latinized version of Philistine, he changed the name to Palestinia. That's where the word Palestine was first used. And it was a general designation for the land. Everybody understood there'd never been a nation called the Palestinians. When the Jews started returning to the land at the turn of the 20th century, invited to legally, and Jews and Arabs had both been living in the land this time, again, Arabs because of Muslim expansion from Muhammad telling them to go on a jihad. You did not have Arabs in any great number there before. Jews and Arabs were both there, but when more Jews came in, you know who was called the Palestinians? The British and the United Nations, the Jews were referred to as the Palestinians. The Arabs who lived in the land, what did they call themselves? Hold on to your seat. They called themselves Arabs. The term Palestinian was coined by Yasser Arafat, who, interestingly enough, wasn't even born in that region, was born in Egypt. And he coined the Palestinians and went on record to say, we cannot defeat Israel militarily. We must wage a publicity campaign against them. And so he started talking about the Palestinians as this poor, persecuted people. Well, these people who at the time called themselves Arabs, what happened? How did they get dislodged from their homes? Well, many of them did not. Many of the Arabs, when Israel became a nation, stayed in Israel, and their descendants live there today. There's thousands. There's over 10,000 Arabs that live in Israel, and they have more rights in Israel than any Arab in any Arab country, unless we're talking about the government or aristocracy. They stayed. Why did the others leave? They left because the surrounding nations, like Egypt, they said, we're coming through. We don't want a two-state solution. We are coming through. Either join our army or get out of the way. But if you get out of the way, it's only going to take a short while. I mean, we're going to kill all the Jews. We're going to massacre them. I already read some texts where they said they were going to massacre them. So the Arabs who lived in this land that was called Palestine, who did not call themselves Palestinians, they joined them. And then miraculously, against incredible odds, Israel won that war. And so then we had the question, well, what do we do with these people? Slowly but surely, Israel has given them land back. They turned over the Gaza Strip. And the Palestinians rewarded them how? By burning down Jewish synagogues and firing missiles into Israel just about every day. When somebody accidentally burns a Quran, that concerns people. When Muslims burn down synagogues, that doesn't concern them.
Okay, Mr. Ahmed, your concluding statement. You get the remaining amount of the time.
Okay. Well, you know, I think Bob has vented a lot of anger, a lot of hostility towards Muslims, and with good reason. They've done a lot of hateful things. On the other side, have also done a lot of hateful things to them. There is so much hate and animosity that it's even hard to have a debate like this. Seriously, I mean, we are talking about political issues and how disgusting and vile Muslims are and all the bad things they've done. And they've done bad things. But there's also a lot of good Muslims as well. But really, this was supposed to be a discussion focused on the scriptures, but it turn, you know, into a political discussion. It shouldn't have. But the important point here is, and this is something which Bob really didn't address during the entire discussion, that when you have Christians falsely interpret their Bibles for Jews to hold on to the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and all this territory which they invaded in 1967, they justify this occupation with Bible verses. There is a refugee camp with 3 million Palestinians there. 3 million Palestinians have been made refugees. And these terrorist Americans are going to justify that with Bible verses. They say this is Jewish land. But this nonsense has been going on for 1,400 years. Christians have been interpreting their Bibles to wage war against Muslims. And these hypocrites are going to turn around and talk about Osama bin Laden. Okay, well, Allahu Akbar. I'm not like one of these fanatics who misuse religion to wage war and violence. Okay, so I want people to make that distinction. As for this nonsense about burning down churches, as you see, Bob didn't give a single quotation from the Islamic text which teaches that. Chapter 9, verse 73. There, if you go to a website called Islam Awakened, you'll get dozens of translations there. I'm looking through each and every translation here, IslamAwakened.com, and it's got all these cool translations. No, it doesn't have the NJ Dawood, but if you look there, none of them say because they uttered a word of disbelief. This is a myth, okay, that Islam teaches to wage war against people because they're disbelievers. That's just lies and misrepresentation. Not that I just think Bob has been going to anti-Islamic websites right. that fed him
okay.
this.
Okay, we basically we're pretty much here at the end of the show here. But thank you very much, Mr. Ahmed and Mr. Siegel, for participating in this. Thank you.
And I did say at the top of the show that I didn't believe Nadir was lying. He told me later on that I called him a liar. Went on my way to not say that. We will see you next week, everybody.
Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.